Welcome to another episode of Fukin Conversation, talking about academic-y stuff with Dr. Lindsay Gibson. Dr. Gibson is an assistant professor in the Department of Curriculum and Pedagogy at the University of British Columbia. And just prior to that, he was a professor in the Department of Elementary Education at the University of Alberta. And even before that, he taught for 12 years as a secondary school history and social studies teacher. I'm part of, so excited to talk to you today, Lindsay, about the different work that you do. I know that for over a decade now that you've been collaborating with different organizations like the Critical Thinking Consortium, TC Squared, Historica, and other important projects across the country. And I know, you know, I don't often get to catch up with you enough when you've been here in Ottawa to facilitate the annual Historical Thinking Summer Institute in partnership with Canada History. But I did get a chance to catch up with you, I think, it was about a month ago, out in your hometown in Kelowna. And I had such a great time. I was able to meet a lot of your friends that are there and are part of the local community. And it was just amazing to go out for walks with you and for you to teach me about the local history in Kelowna. So welcome to the show today, Lindsay.
Thanks very much. Great introduction.
Thank you. Hey, so, you know, where are you in Kelowna or Vancouver right now?
Yeah, I'm in Kelowna. In the traditional Sioux territory, and my partner and I just got back a couple of days ago after being in Vancouver for the whole time. But we're pretty much come here to settle in over the next few months. It looks like like a lot of people during this very unusual time.
And how has it been out in Vancouver prior to going to Kelowna?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I feel in a lot of ways it's kind of similar to, I think, what Duane said. We're really privileged as academics that, you know, when people tell us to social distance, we, you know, we sort of say, well, what's different about that than what our normal life is? But, you know, we're really privileged to be able to continue working and thinking and doing this work. But, you know, I think everything's been very much the same except for, you know, far less interactions with colleagues and conversations in that kind of way. And I feel like in some ways it's been harder to concentrate on your work. You know, we always think about what it would be like to live through history, and then we're living through it. And it's something that requires a lot of deep thought to think about this, how it's impacting people and what we're all going through.
How have you felt like things have been at UBC in relation to the current context? I know here at the University of Ottawa, we were given about 3 days to shift to think about how we might transition our courses to being online. And pretty much, I think most of my colleagues were able to do so. We were in the midst of trying to finish up our teacher education program for students. And so there was still a couple weeks left where they had coursework to do. I was lucky enough because I already had a course that was completely online, but I did have a course that was blended. And unfortunately, we had to finish out the last three classes online. I know those students would have loved to finish it out face-to-face. I'm just wondering if the circumstances is the same at UBC in terms of your own teaching, if you're teaching the semester.
Yeah, I finished teaching I taught a compressed class that finished at the end of January, and before the secondary social studies students went on practicum. So I haven't taught since then, and I'm actually not teaching them until May, till mid-May again. When they come back from practicum, we have something called an inquiry class. So they've been inquiring into topics of personal relevance and meaning to them. So I'm not teaching right now, but my colleagues are all sort of transitioning. And so I've been lucky to kind of follow the conversations and do a lot of reading and ask people for a lot of advice. I have only pretty much taught face to face, although, you know, I have created through the online collaborative systems at UBC. I've been creating, you know, what I think are, you know, they're in-person face-to-face classes, but there's a lot of content that could be used asynchronously. So we're having meetings, and, you know, I'm a month and a bit away from teaching again. And so, you know, I really benefit from the space that we're having in meet. I know we have a meeting next week with a bunch of us about how we're going to deliver this, this next course. And, you know, reading a lot on Twitter and social media too, about how teachers are dealing with this and, you know, how it's changed things. And I think people have had some really deep realizations about face-to-face instructions and the value of that. But also the benefits and limitations of doing things in online. And then not only that, but doing things, the benefits and limitations of doing things online during a really traumatic experience that's going on for a lot of people, because that's a lot different too, right? And, you know, how, when we think about equity and impact on other people and what that looks like and how we can, you know, as educators, how are we going to thoughtfully do that in ways that doesn't cause harm to our students and is really equitable at the same time? It's really complicated.
Are you like me? Like, I, you know, usually I'm probably once in the morning and then throughout the day kind of checking the numbers, whether it's on Twitter or CBC in terms of the numbers it has.
Yeah, my partner is on top of it. She's been for, I think, 3 weeks now following. Johns Hopkins University has a really, I think, is one of the most reliable sites in sort of tracking around the world. And so she's been really using that and a few other websites. So she kind of keeps me up to date on all that. I have been reading, you know, I kind of read in the morning when I wake up. I read Twitter for an hour, like my, like a newspaper almost, you know, reading headlines in my kind of curated collection. And then I haven't been reading a lot during the day because I'm writing right now. And then I've been reading it again in the evening kind of thing. And I, you know, I've also, for my own sanity, the first few days I was just on all the time and it was just, I couldn't concentrate. So I had to, for sanity reasons, almost had to do that. And the other interesting kind of reaction for me has been, I looked a lot into the past. You know, I kind of joke with people all the time that my interests around history all the time, that when people say, you know, in the present, oh, what's happening with this or what's happening? Sometimes I feel the sense of, well, you know, we don't know the full story yet, and not that we ever will, but we're going to find out more as things move on. So, you know, it's pointless sort of speculating about it. So what I've really tried to do is dive into past pandemics and do thinking about that, specifically the 1918, 1919 pandemic, to see just like, how did people react and what did they do? And what were the different reactions in different communities across Canada and different provinces? How did it impact people? How did they respond? What did they think they were going through? Like, I've used that as a sense of trying to help me think about, you know, how to respond in the present and really in lots of ways thinking about the future.
Well, I know in your work that you've and especially in the works that you were able to generously share with me before our talk is that you've looked in your work at different historical events and their historical significance. And so what is it in terms of the research that you've done so far that you've been able to pieced together from that work in relation to how you might think about the different concepts in relation to historical thinking, specifically in terms of that? And then also, are you doing anything in terms of documenting this moment in time to be later used in the future?
I actually haven't myself. I've been really lucky in that I've been working on a project with the Seven Oaks School Division in Winnipeg. Matt Henderson is someone I just met over the years and really admire the work that he's doing. He's an assistant superintendent in innovation and does work really supporting a lot of teachers. And so he put together a group with Nagan Sinclair and myself and Adele Perry and Kian McMahon and some historians and some other people. And for Manitoba 150 this year, we've been creating a monthly provocation, we're calling it, a monthly question built around some historical source or sources, a question that elementary and secondary students in French and English are responding to. The French ones are up on the Radio Canada website, and the English ones, I think, are up on the 7-0 School Division sites. And then students have sort of been responding. So we've been creating these since January. Each one builds, focuses on a historical thinking concept and a particular topic in Manitoba history. And, you know, I have some deep Manitoba roots through my parents. You know, they both grew up there and I would go to visit my grandparents there in the summertime. So we did one for March all around the impact of the pandemic the 1918-1919 pandemic in Winnipeg. And it was all built around this one source that Adele found in the Manitoba Telegraph, or is it the Winnipeg Telegraph? Anyways, and it was all about how you should respond to the flu. And so we created a piece, and it was really around with students a few concepts, continuity and change. How is what they're recommending as a response to the flu of 1918-1919, how is that similar or different than what we're hearing and how we're reacting in the present? What does historical perspectives, what does how they responded and what the big issues are, what does that tell us about their values and beliefs at the time and the different perspectives that existed? So the historical perspective. So that's really been, you know, something that I've worked on. And then because I've been active on Twitter, I've been trying to share these different resources. And, you know, we have such a great network of people across Canada working on these different projects that, you know, people are contacting me. My friend Martin Hubley, who's at the Museum of Nova Scotia, you know, he sent me a link and said, hey, we built this really amazing website last year around the impact of the pandemic in Nova Scotia. Here you go. So I tweet that one out. My friend Glenn Thielman from Prince George sent one out that they developed for students around the impacts in Prince George. And so I've just basically been like a conduit and sending out all of these different things. And there was a really great one from the Guelph Museum, which was like, okay, how can we help our students? You know, the Winnipeg example that we use, we were thinking, how can we help these Winnipeg people, like, yeah, deepen their historical thinking abilities in some ways, but more importantly, like, give them a sense of hope and also understanding about what this means in the present and, you know, what these impacts are, and to try and reduce that level of tension and fear that students were feeling. So hopefully it did that. And one of the activities the Guelph Museum was talking about was, you know, two things around evidence. And they said to students, you know, what we'd like you to think about is what, if you were a curator or an archivist right now in your home community, what kind of evidence would you collect that is going to tell the story of the impact, the consequences of COVID-19 on your community? So there's that part about that evidence piece and recognizing that they're historical actors and that, you know, evidence is being created, some of it on, you know, for posterity reasons, for consciously, and some of them that just happen to be generated this time period. And then I've seen a lot of great posts as well and sent them out as well, as getting students to say, okay, I'm going to document my experience with this. Like, so someone wants to know what a grade 5 or a grade 10 student went through. How am I going to document that? And, you know, not only just thinking about what am I going to say about it, but what medium am I going to, you know, collect that in? Is it going to be a TikTok on my phone? Is it going to be, you know, are we going to write a diary? Are we going to, you know, what kinds of methods are going to be used to be able to do that? So, you know, I guess, you know, like I've seen a lot of things, you know, I heard the guy from Death Cab for Cutie, Ben Gibbard, talking about how he's been posting these songs, live performances that he does every day, and people have been thanking him. He said, hey, don't thank me. Like, this, I'm just trying, this is actually for me. I need this for my brain and to help me really cope with this. And I would say the same thing about this with me, is that, you know, to help and develop resources and work with other people and send things out and, you know, provide things for teachers that they can use with their students right now, both synchronously and asynchronously. That's what I've been doing for 15 years or more in my life. And so I really feel like that helps me, you know, keep a sense of normalcy at the same time.
In terms of the sharing through social media, whether that's your colleagues or your own research, are you conscious of any curriculum documents in any of the provinces that actually took up the 1918-1919 pandemic? Because that's a question that some of the teachers here in the local area are now asking me. Thank you for sharing those resources. But also, I'm just thinking in terms of the history or social studies curriculum, if that's ever mentioned, from what you know in relation to some of the curriculum policies across the country.
It's so hard to say because, I mean, what is included in curriculum documents across Canada in just different jurisdictions is so different. Like, you know, BC's curriculum content outcomes, for example, are so generic in their terminology, you know, whereas other places are really prescriptive in them. So I don't know. I can't say off the top of my head, like, do people say you must learn about the Spanish flu, but they might learn about public health, or they might learn about, like, you know, economic consequences and changes over time, you know, in those kind of ways. They might look at significant events. And so, you know, the thing is with all, with the pandemic, why, you know, and I feel this way about so many topics, is they really illuminate historical thinking concepts, which I spend my time thinking about on a regular basis. So whether it be evidence, which I've already talked about, continuity and change, so how things have stayed the same and change, but also things like cause and consequence. So what caused this, and how, you know, how similar or different is that than previous ones? And, you know, when we look at the epidemic of 1918-20, and then what are the consequences? And consequences both, you know, kind of expected consequences, but unexpected ones, you know, things that we haven't really imagined we would ever, you know, people, for example, who've been fighting for more, you know, economic justice or united, you know, universal basic income, all of a sudden they see, you know, never did I imagine that one of the consequences of COVID was that we're going to be thinking about, hey, we might get a bit of a chance here to, you know, this has really exacerbated the cracks in capitalism and colonialism and some of those other things. Maybe this is an opportunity to rethink anew about what the future might bring. And so, you know, getting students to think about those kind of possibilities, but also I think something really powerful is thinking about the future. And, you know, what, when we deal with the ethical dimension, what is always dealing with, people always think, yes, I'm making ethical judgments about the past or how we should remember the past or what we should, what are obligations. But I would say a big part of this too is, what are our ethical obligations in the future? Knowing what we do now about pandemics and about disease, what kinds of actions should we be taking, both as government and as individuals and other kind of ways, to make sure that we've learned from this, and that we make sure for the good of everybody that these things don't happen again.
So what do you think about the kind of the way in which politicians and health professionals and scientists are dealing with this? So, for example, you know, collecting data, trying to come up with mathematical models to predict how it's spreading based on the data that they have from other places. And I'm just wondering, you know, in terms of the work that you do and thinking about time in relation to how we document different events over time in history, it seems to me that we do have, although if we think over a continuum, a compressed amount of data being shared over a short period of time. And I'm curious to know what your thoughts are about the role of historians or even history education in relation to what you outlined in terms of continuity and change and cause and consequence in relation to, say, for example, trying to learn what were some of the early responses or late responses to what took place during the 1918 or 1919 pandemic. So I'm just wondering what kind of insights you might have on that.
You know, I think a few things. Like, you know, the first thing that came to my mind is I'm writing right now about virtual reality. And we worked on this project together with the DOOR project, but I'm writing a paper about virtual reality in history education. And one of the thinkers in it that I've been reading a lot about, it, the last name is Staley, and I don't know, it's D. Staley. I don't know the first name. Anyways, Staley talks about this idea that virtual reality is always, it's a, you know, we have to be really clear with students that these are all constructions, right? And they're all interpretations, whether it be in a textbook or in a historian's book or, you know, a film or a virtual reality experience, they're all constructed like secondary sources. And that really strikes me in the same way that, you know, and he talks a lot about virtual reality as a model, as an abstract model, and way of telling a narrative. Well, you know, all the stats and graphs and things that we're seeing are the exact same thing, right? They're models and they're constructed and they need to be interpreted, and they're approximations and they're imperfect. And this is really important to understand, right? But it tells us a lot about society that, you know, instantly we want to be able to quantify this, that we want to be able to say, hey, how exactly is this going to spread? And what are these numbers and what do these predictions look like? And how do we need to act in regard to, based on what we're seeing on these different levels, which I think is a really, you know, I think it's a really fascinating, I think it's a really fascinating part of it.
Yeah, that answers part of it. I'm just wondering how, in terms of the timeline, so if we think of history and timeline, how that might change, because I know in some of your works you talk about over time, once we get a certain perspective and more information, the perspective over time might change in relation to what we're experiencing in the moment.
Yeah. And one of the, you know, in these historical thinking concepts, one of the things about that Satius talks about, for example, is about being really careful about drawing lessons from the past, right? That we know that the past and present, yes, they may be rhyme, they may have some similarities, but there's also some significant differences, and we don't want to pretend like it's a play-by-play book. But at the same time period, we'd be crazy if we said, we're not going to pay attention at all. Like, none of that has any relevance. Everyone was so different then, you know, all of those kind of things. And so, you know, my friend Daniel Marshall, who's a public historian in Victoria, wrote a great book last year about the Fraser Canyon Gold Rush. He just wrote two pieces for the Orca on the Spanish flu in BC and the impact of, sorry, I don't want to call it the Spanish flu, the 1918-1919 pandemic. And what he talked about was, he said, you know, Victoria, for example, I think Vancouver had about a 10-12% death rate of the people who were infected by the flu. So I think BC had 4,000 deaths, 1,000 of them were from Vancouver at the time period, which was roughly the same size of Victoria. And Victoria had a 3% death rate of people that got infected. And the difference was, the chief medical officer from Victoria was on top of the news reports. He's hearing from cities all across Canada about what's happening. And it wasn't like the flu was moving east to west necessarily, but he was able to be right on top of it early on. And he recognized what was going on and shut it down. And he shut the city down, basically a 1918 version of social isolation. No one's going to be meeting in more than this many people. There's no public events. There's no city events. Everything shut down. Business are shut down. Only essentials, you know, da, 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 da. And he basically was able to flatten the curve. But he struggled because people were, businesses and other kinds of groups were saying, this is too harsh, it's going to cost us too much, you know, so on and so forth. And this is in October of 1918. Well, the armistice that ends World War I happens in, as a lot of everyone knows, November 11th, 1918. He was under such immense public pressure that the chief medical officer released the regulations and allowed people to congregate. They wanted to celebrate. They wanted to be together to mark this momentous occasion. And surprise, surprise, a second wave of the flu came in January of 1919. So like a month and a half later or whatever else. So, you know, so that for me was really instructive in my own life. Like how, okay, you know, my partner was really on top of it. We're constantly following. Things were changing, right? On a day-to-day, on a moment-to-moment basis. Don't do this, do this, do that, don't do that. And I was, you know, early on, because of this historical work that I was reading, was saying, we need to, you know, we just need to shut this down, and we need to keep it shut for as long as possible. And we have to be patient about it, you know, that people are going to say, oh, well, we can do it for a week, or we can do it for 2 weeks. Like, we're in here for the long haul. But it's like a lot of things. If we show patience, if we do it the right way, if we make sure people are looked after, that this is going to have the least amount of impact. And it's very similar to what the WHO, you know, I think lead doctor said, that it kind of went viral in the early days of it. And he said that perfect is the danger in this thing, that if governments stop and wait till they try and have the perfect solution, they'll have lost time, that it's perfection is the enemy of doing the right thing at the time period. So we need to act. We know that we're going to make mistakes, but then we need to be able to recover from those quick mistakes, but we can't sit on our hands. And that, I think, that response in Canada, as we're seeing versus, you know, if we compare ourselves in the situation that the United States is unfortunately currently in, that seems to have been a big difference, right? And that ability to be able to react and do that. So, you know, I think that's, you know, what I'm talking about, I guess, in some sense is this notion of historical consciousness, this big concept that says it's not learning history for the sake of history, but how do we use the past? How do we use our understanding of the past and history to orient our lives in the present and make decisions for the future? And, you know, I guess in this way, for an infrequent time, I've actually practiced what I preach, essentially.
So for social studies and history teachers, can you So I have a question. I've got lots of questions for you, but my first question is, you know, what do you think of the different actors that are making some of the decisions that have a widely societal impact on the Canadian public or even internationally in terms of other countries? And then thinking, you've made reference to some of the historical actors that made a difference for their communities. I'm curious about how are you thinking about our politicians as one example, or the health profession in general, or the scientists that are helping analyze some of the data and then help us make some of the policy decisions. That the part of it, but I'm really curious to know a little bit more about historical thinking in relation to what you've talked about in some of your work in reference to Peter Sagius and others' work about first order concepts and second order concepts in relation to historical thinking. And then how would one situate historical actors or even actors in the present in relation to those concepts?
So in terms of, you know, one of the big, so there's these six concepts, and the first order and second order thing is, you know, I think it sounds, I remember hearing it as a graduate student, it sounds more complicated than it really is. First order concepts are the stuff of history, the content of history. And so, you know, it might be something like democracy, right? It might be something, but it might be a colligatory concept like the French Revolution or the Industrial Revolution. It might be a peasant. And the idea is that these are first order concepts that, yes, they change over time. Our understanding of them changes over time, but it's the stuff that history focuses on, right? World War II or total war, right? These kinds of concepts. The stuff that we want students to learn, the what we learn about. So that's the first order part of it. And second order concepts are concepts that almost like organizing concepts, concepts help us make sense of those other things. So in history, second order concepts form the sort of backbone or vertebrae of what the discipline of history is. So for example, historians oftentimes will tell you, well, what is history really? Oh, it's the study of change over time. So one of the key concepts is continuity and change, which we've talked about. Okay, well, if I want to look at, if the concept is pandemics, I'm going to look at that. That's our first order concept. A second order approach to that might be, I'm going to look at how pandemics have changed and, you know, or in people's reaction to pandemics or even pandemics in general. Like, okay, the last one, major one was in 1918. Now we have one almost exactly 100 years of the day. Does that mean we're about bound to get pandemics every 100 years? Is that continuity and change? So that's how it kind of relates to it in that way. Now, in terms of the role of actors, one of the other fundamental concepts is cause and consequence. And, you know, my understanding and how I articulate these concepts to other people, yes, they're concepts like we can teach them to students and we can name them and they have characteristics and features and all of these different things that we can, you know, we could mind map them or I could define them for you in those particular ways. But these concepts also work in history is that they're tensions and problems and portals, some people call them, like they underpin our ability to actually be able to do history. And so one of the fundamental questions that we ask, so we say, well, how much of things change and how much of things stay? And that's continuity and change. One of the other fundamental questions we ask is, what causes things to happen? What causes events to happen? And what are the consequences of those? So cause and consequence is another one. So in a case like this, when we're thinking about, you know, how do societies respond to these pandemics? And, you know, when we look back, I told you a story about Victoria. I focused on the actions of a chief medical officer. But I didn't talk about the various people in the community who actually locked that town down and made sure that people were taken care of in the hospitals and in the homes and businesses and what impact that had on businesses and families and workers and all, you know, and how did the flu impact the Songhees people, the Lekwungen people in, you know, in Victoria at this time period. So, you know, there's all of these other kinds of questions. And so when we think about cause and consequences, we think about the actors themselves, but you know, one of the fundamental questions, not only in history, but in social science, is the relationship between structures, you know, the sort of structural conditions that lead events to happen, and the actions of individuals, right? So whereas a Marxist would see themselves on this idea that, you know, it's the relations, it's the structures that cause events to happen, whether you like it or not. Other people believe in things where, oh, it's these actions of these individuals that make these things happen. It's Martin Luther King. It's, you know, John A. McDonald with Confederation. It's all of these things that these are these actors who bring these into play. And the I think the wonderful, one of the wonderful things about history is getting students to think about these interplays. So, you know, how do we look at these individuals right now in the present and saying, well, is it Justin Trudeau who's done a great job? And I'm not saying he's done a great job, but, you know, if people who are saying that and say, hey, Justin Trudeau's done a really great job because he recognizes first off and he did these actions versus Trump and he didn't do these things and he didn't do those. Is it all the individual? But if we give too much credence to the individuals, what about the actual individuals who are implementing these strategies and who are taking responsibility for them? What about the structures that were actually in place, whether it be private healthcare versus public healthcare versus like a belief in the role of the state in the individual's lives and beliefs and those things? So, you know, this is the difficult work of history, is like trying to sort these things out. And in terms of history education, how do we invite students of varying ages into these kinds of conversations and into these really interesting, you know, debates about what causes things to happen?
And then in relation to the actors, and what I found that in your work that you've been focusing on, and either on your own and thinking about it or with colleagues or working with teachers in the schools, is as part of the ethical dimensions of the historical thinking concepts, ethical judgments or ethical judgment. So someone like John A. McDonald, and how... Mm-hmm. If you have someone like Tim Stanley and the work that he's taken up mm-hmm. in relation to John A. McDonald and examining how, you know, Canada is a settler colonial state and the perpetuation of white supremacy in relation to John A. and that work, and then working with students then to discuss the ethical dimensions of studying the policies perhaps that someone like John A. put forth during his time. So I was just wondering if you could comment a little bit about that. And I'd like to hear, yeah, about how either, you know, your thoughts on it, and then how some of the teachers are working through it.
Yeah, well, you know, it's really interesting because, you know, you and I have chatted in our time together just about our stories and how we came to kind of this work. And, you know, I was a high school teacher in Kelowna, and I was working, and I did a master's at UBC Okanagan here in Kelowna when it just transferred over to when UBC just created as a sample. It existed what was called Okanagan University College before. And I started my master's and I was working in critical thinking. And I did kind of a self-study, theoretical inquiry into critical thinking and what is it and what does it look like in classrooms. And I implemented stuff with five different history classes, grade 12 history classes, world history classes as part of my master's. And as I was going through, and it was a generic model of historical thinking, of critical thinking that I was working with. And there were certain things and concepts and things that we were dealing with in class that was like, hey, critical thinking, or this generic model of critical thinking that could be subject unspecific, couldn't do some of these things, and it couldn't answer some of these particular things. And my master's supervisor was connected with Rolling Case at the time period, and it's like 2006. And the first book, Teaching Historical Thinking, that Roland wrote with Mike Dinos, and it was edited by Peter Satius. And it was the first kind of like major popular publication around historical thinking. Peter had published a couple other pieces in you know, anthologies and social studies anthologies and some other things. And, you know, I remember getting the book, and I still have it. It's dog-eared pages now and everything, and going through it and looking at these concepts. And I always describe it to people as like, you know, I'd studied history in university. I had taught history now for 7 or 8 years in a school, and seeing this book, and it was literally like someone turned the lights on. And it wasn't like I'd never thought of these things before. I hadn't approached any of these concepts or even stumbled into using some of these concepts in my teaching. What it was like someone had provided a language for me to talk to my students and to my colleagues and to other people about what it means to do history. That when we say to students, hey, we want them to think historically, we want them to do and inquire into history in a community about these really important questions, that it really did that. And so that was really exciting at the time period. And these concepts are flawed. There's a few holes in them. There's a few missing pieces. I'd love to talk about any critiques or other kind of things that, you know, that we have at the same time period. But the one concept that I really gravitated towards was the ethical, at the time period, it was called ethical judgment. I think Peter calls it the ethical dimension, because it's not, he sees it as being more than just ethical judgments. But, and the reason why is I had historical training as an undergraduate student at SFU in Burnaby, and had got up and pass on these understandings of the discipline to your students that you think are sort of canonical in a discipline, and then you realize that maybe they're not. So, you know, I used to talk to a lot of my students like, you know, hey, when we write history, it's really meant to be in third person. Like, you know, it's not I or me, it's not personal in that way. We're really trying to be, this kind of faux objectivity and neutrality. And I was always really interested about how teachers, what did they do when they dealt with these really complicated ethical questions in history? And we have tons in Canadian history. You talked about, you know, how do we talk about the legacy of John A. Macdonald and taking down a statue? How do we talk about the famous five, the women, and, you know, some of them, how many talk about Tommy Douglas, this person that was highlighted as, you know, the greatest Canadian in the CBC poll and the father of healthcare, who also studied eugenics at Chicago University. You know, these are dealing with this nuance and this complication of humans and judgments and all those kind of things. And so it really led me into like, okay, what's happening? And so as I was finishing my master's, I applied, you know, I was really excited and I applied to do my PhD at UBC with Peter. And I had this idea, like, I want to do something around this concept. Like, I really want to research this concept and see what teachers are doing with it. And I always say to students, to my graduate students and other people that I get a chance of working with, I always say to them, like, you know, don't worry if you don't have your idea, like, things are going to emerge as you go along. Yet at the same time period, I had this unusual experience. I don't know if yours is the same, but it's like, I didn't know specifically, but I had a rough sketch that I want to do something with this concept in doing this particular work. So my research was really about, you know, I surveyed all of the teachers in a certain grade level of teaching Canadian history in the school district in Kelowna. And it was a survey about their attitudes about teaching history and, you know, basic demographic stuff, but it was about their approach to teaching about these ethical issues. And I was looking really at five issues in Canadian history: Japanese Canadian internment, the conscription crisis of 1917, the Chinese head tax. I can't remember what the other two were. It's been so long ago now. Anyways, so I surveyed them on their attitudes towards teaching them. And I asked them, you know, what did they think it was okay ever to give their own opinion? Was it okay to ask their students to make ethical judgments about whether that was right or wrong? How did they deal with the fact that the times in the past might have been very different than today, and like this whole presentist idea, and how did they do around that? And then I analyzed the survey results, and I kind of categorized teachers that I had interviewed in this or that I'd surveyed in this particular way. And I identified four of them, and I said, look, I really want to come and, you know, watch how you're teaching. And so I went and watched when they would teach about these ethically controversial events. I would go and interview them ahead of time, watch the class, video the class, collect all the student work, collect the lesson plans, collect and analyze all the resources, learning resources that they used. And then, you know, that was basically the material for the study. And it's not, the findings aren't groundbreaking in any sense. It would probably tell us what we all probably know about ethical judgments. What the teachers essentially said is they said, you know, they recognized that ethical judgments were inevitable, that historians made them, that they were made in movies, they're made in textbooks, they're made in films, that they're unavoidable. But in a strange kind of understanding, the teachers all said, yes, even though I understand that in my classroom, I don't make them very often. I don't do that. I'm generally more of that kind of referee. And if you look at Diana Hess and Paula McAvoy's work about, you know, the political classroom, you know, around controversial issues, like contemporary issues, that teachers take that same similar kind of attitude, right? Like, oh, I can be a devil's advocate or a questioner or whatever else, and I don't ever reveal my own judgments. I'm more a referee and this neutral kind of person. And that's what they said in the, you know, that's what they said in their surveys. That's what they said to me in the interviews and the post interviews. But then when we looked at it in the classroom, it's just like ethical judgments were everywhere. And it's not to, that's not to say that as like a bad thing. The teacher's like, tisk, tisk, you shouldn't have done that. But it was like that they weren't aware of the various ways that ethical judgments were embedded in everything that they did, in the language that they used, in how much time and energy and the way they describe things, right? There's an old Raoul Hilberg, one of the great historians of the Shoah, of the Holocaust, said, you know, I tried to write a history of the Holocaust in objective language or a neutral language, and I gave up after the first sentence, right? Like every word that we use, well, are they a villain? Are they a hero? Are they, you know, the ways that we frame these things, the words, what we say, what details we include, all of these are really big pieces of that.
That's what I saw in your study, was that, you know, teachers came at ethical judgment differently. So for example, you shared how some teachers present material that already have embedded certain ethical judgments about whether it's actors or policies about the past. It might be in the material or evidence that they present, the way in which they present the evidence, the kinds of questions that they ask the students to engage in relation to the first order concepts that they might be looking at. And I'm just wondering, you know, today, for teachers, whether it's in a social studies class or a history classroom, if they might, if they'd even be permitted to ask such a kind of question. Like, I'm just thinking in terms of someone like Senator Bayak about promoting the possibilities on top of the atrocities of the Indian residential schooling system, and then asking students to kind of look at the evidence in the past to make an ethical judgment about that. And you know, especially in terms of where you're at, out on the West Coast and some of the schools, and then perhaps here locally in Ottawa, if you have First Nations students that are in the class who have had grandparents that went to the Indian residential schools, to even ask that kind of question about taking up an ethical judgment in relation to those first order events. For example, the question like what's been the intergenerational impacts of the Indian residential schooling system? What's your thoughts on addressing such kinds of historical questions in the classroom in relation to that the very concept of ethical judgment? And I know here in the Ontario curriculum, they've situated as the framework for teaching social studies and history through historical thinking and some of the concepts, but they didn't include the ethical dimension as one of the concepts, because they said it would cause too many issues in the classroom, as if teachers weren't taking up those issues with their students outside of those historical thinking concepts. So I don't, what are your thoughts on that? Yeah.
Well, I mean, obviously that Ontario piece is really interesting because, you know, I was a grad student when lots of curricular reform was first beginning to happen, and Ontario was one of the first really to really meaningfully take up historical thinking. But then, you know, like you said, evidence was kind of moved into more of an inquiry piece. The ethical dimension was like put into these like citizenship outcomes with like 30 other outcomes or whatever. And so it was just around, you know, continuing change, cause and consequence, perspectives, and significance were the only four things. And, you know, it's actually really interesting that you asked that question, because it's kind of like that decision kind of mirrors the findings of the study, right? Is that, oh, well, we're going to put this out. We think it's controversial, so we're just going to not deal with it and think that it's not happening. But it is happening, and they're dealing with these questions. And I think I've been drawn to the ethical dimension because it's so complicated and because, you know, it's not clear cut. And exactly as you said, I think it's the one, you know, teachers always, in preliminary research, the ethical dimension is the one concept teachers are most leery about, which is, I think, pretty understandable. And they're unsure with really how to deal with it. And I get that because it is a bit It's not cut and dry. So for example, your example about Lynn Bayak, for example, or dealing with residential schools, I'm never going to frame an ethical judgment question to my students and say, so was residential schools good or bad? Right? Was this a good thing or a bad thing? That's really problematic. But because so there are cases in history where they are clear, open and shut, ethically unjust actions. Right. Even the main one that I looked at in my dissertation research, Japanese Canadian internment, it's pretty universal. I mean, the government apologized. I mean, there was only one historian, Jack Granitstein, who, when I looked at the historiography, he said, look, the dispossession and the deportations that happened was totally unjust. But the initial evacuation, and keep in mind, he used the word evacuation, not forcible removal or anything like that. He's choosing a very ethically, you know, loaded word. He chose that evacuation. He said it was justified, and it was justified because there was so much racism that there would have been damage to the Japanese community and deaths and all of these things. So they had to remove them for their own safety, right? That's his argument. But every other historian totally said, no, this is every aspect of this was totally unjust. So it's not really a great question to ask students, well, was this justified or unjustified? 95% of the students are going to say it was unjustified. But what becomes more interesting in the ethical dimension, and there's a few different aspects of it, it's that, okay, yes, we have these open shuts. Another possible question that we might ask, though, is who, if we accept that it was unjust, or we accept that it was just, for example, we have to look at other examples as well, not just always the injustices, but if we accept that it was just or unjust, then there's no point asking an ethical judgment question. What we might want to do instead is talk about responsibility. So, it was ethically unjust. Who do we hold up as being responsible for residential schools, right? And if we had to assign or think about responsibility, who would it be? Would it be the architects, the designers of residential schools, like Johnny McDonald, like Langevin, who we've seen bridges named, renamed in Calgary, the building at the Prime Minister's office in Ottawa. Is it the people who carried out the policy, people like Duncan Campbell Scott, Cindy Blackstock, you know, in Beechwood Cemetery, putting the plaques on there saying, hey, this is the person that knowingly carried out this, knowing that there was harm caused to these particular people. Is it people like Nicholas Flood Davin? Davin wrote the Davin Report in 1879 that recommended, after touring American schools like the Carlisle School and other ones, recommended to the Canadian government, hey, we should go into this business of government-funded church-run schools. We think it's a really good model to go for, et cetera, et cetera. Is it someone like that? But it's also, is it other people, the people who are working in schools, the principals, the teachers, the nuns, the nurses, the missionaries, you know, all of these different groups, the RCMP who are enforcing Indian Act regulations and going out to, you know, Indigenous communities and forcing kids to attend school. You know, like, how do we think about this complex ethical kind of issue? I mean, one of the worries I always have is that every single presentation I ever go to at residential schools highlights Duncan Campbell Scott and highlights, you know, kill the Indian and the child. It's a horrific quote. I get it. But if we just blame him and say, hey, this is the person that's responsible for all this, it really does absolve us of our responsibility in colonialism, of really getting to the true truth of the matter. And the truth of the matter is that there's always people who are going to act in these ways and are going to claim, like, I don't have any personal responsibility. The third element of the ethical dimension that is also really worthwhile asking students beyond the ethical judgment, beyond asking them responsibility, is then saying, okay, great. The third option is, what do we do in the present knowing that we know? So how should we respond? And this is both to the injustices of the past, but also the sacrifices. How do we remember the people who really did good, who cared about others, who cared about ethical relations with others, who looked after those people? Like, is it that we want to raise statues to them? Do we want to name things after them? Do we want to use them to teach about and all of these kind of things? So that's why it's such a nuanced concept. And, you know, the reason it becomes very difficult is every community is totally different, right? So, you know, if I'm a teacher in Vancouver, for example, or the Lower Mainland, and I'm in a South Asian community, the Komagata Maru and the continuous, you know, the law of continuous passage in 1914 is a really big topic. And there's, you know, there's going to be some questions I certainly cannot ask about that. And I have to be cognizant of that, in the same way that that would happen in a really, you know, fundamentalist community, you know, Christian fundamentalist community or other kind of ones that, you know, teachers are really worried about these kinds of situations, about asking them. You know, I remember being in Ottawa a few years ago during a rally on Parliament Hill between Armenians, you know, demonstrating into for the recognition of a genocide on the east, you know, the east part of the lawn, and on the west part of the lawn, you had Turkish people who were denying this as even a possibility. I mean, this is, to me, this is what's the exciting part about history. And I think this is to make a bridge to social studies education, is to say, this is why history is so powerful and such an important part of the curriculum, because it really helps us, it really ties together the past and civic engagement and democratic citizenship and all of those kind of things that we've tried to build, is to say, how do we build a more just and inclusive and fair society? And we're going to use these understandings of the past to make these recognitions in the present.
So just going back to where we started the conversation, I had asked you about what you're doing on a daily basis, and if you're checking your to see what's going on in the world in relation to the COVID-19 and the pandemic. Yeah. And part of your response was that you go through what you've curated in your on your Twitter account and kind of read through that like a newspaper. And I'm just wondering, so do you have kind of a system that you take when you're doing that? And do you approach it, you know, does Lindsay Gibson approach it always as someone who loves history or history educator, and the way you curate it? So just thinking, and I'm thinking, do you talk about the way in which you curate, say, for example, your use of Twitter when working with teacher candidates and teacher education, whether that's teaching a methods course or another course within that program?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I had a colleague that I was teaching with in Kelowna. We were seconded teachers working with groups of teachers on inquiry, and she was really into education Twitter. And she's like, oh, you have to get on. I was like, no, I don't. You know, I was like, it's just a bunch of people taking pictures of their dinner, and not even good dinners, like what you take pictures of, you know, just dinners. And then I got onto it, and I realized like, wow, you can really curate this. And I get this idea of a social media bubble, but you can really choose who to follow that you think is going to really, you know, keep you up to date on things, but it's also going to push you, and it's also going to make you have to rethink some of these other assumptions and those kind of ways. And so I always say to my students all the time, I talk to them a lot about Twitter. I regularly will start classes sometimes with 5 or 10 minutes that I show them something really interesting that I saw that has some relevance to teaching social studies and history. And it might be a resource, or it might be something I saw, or a conversation, like something that made me think about something. So I use it in that way, absolutely. And I usually, you know, I'll like things to as a way of documenting them for myself, and I can go back through my likes and see the things that I want to highlight. I hashtag things too for different classes and hashtags and those kind of ways. But I think, you know, the important thing for me, I think, has been, you know, I get people saying all the time, like, oh, it's the great, you know, Twitter is the great cesspool of, you know, of trolls and people saying horrible things. And, you know, we've all had experiences with that to some degree. But I have to say, like, for me, the learning that I've done from Twitter in the last 4 to 5 years, and I'm going to say about being an academic, about, you know, about what's important in terms of my career and my own commitments, ethical commitments. I follow a lot of indigenous scholars because I really wanted to better understand. I wanted to better think. That really challenged me and really pushed my parameters. Curriculum scholars, historians. I mean, you just feel like it's like your interests together that you do them, but also like in casual ways, you know. And what's amazing is that we've built now a network of history educators, for example, around the world that never existed before. So Peter Satius in Canada, Sam Weinberg in the United States, Bob Bain in the United States, Bodo von Borres in Germany, Peter Lee, Dennis Schemmelt in Britain. These kind of are like, you know, they're the Bill Pienaars of history education, right? Like that generation of them. And they met each other, like sometimes peripherally at conferences and other kind of ways. Now there's a next generation of history education scholars. Lots of us are the progeny of these academics. But rather than like reading each other's papers necessarily in TRSE or in other things that are coming out, we're actually keeping in contact via Twitter, and it's instant, right? 2 weeks ago, I was like, oh, I'm working on this paper. I sent a quick tweet to three people. Hey, what have you seen that's the best stuff about this particular topic? They responded within 5 minutes. And then other people who saw their stuff, who follow them, responded. And like literally in 10 minutes, I had a bibliography of stuff that I wouldn't have had otherwise. And it's like, that is pretty amazing. And we were, you know, when we talk about historical moments, we sort of like stood back and said to each other on Twitter, isn't this amazing that we have this opportunity that our supervisors never had, this ability, this instantaneous feedback and collegiality, you know, just like what you're doing right now with the podcast. We had an idea the other day. It's like, hey, we should talk about history education. Like, where do we go now? Like, what do we do in a COVID-19, post-COVID-19, but also in a climate crisis? You know, how do we, you know, what's an approach to history education? Is it going towards more transnational history, getting away from the role of the nation? Like, you know, where are we going to go? And so, you know, that to me is really exciting and a huge possibility about Twitter. And I, you know, knowing also the limitations of it at the same time.
So what would you say have been the key pieces of scholarship that have probably had the biggest impact on your thinking to this date? And then just currently, what are you paying attention to? What are some of those scholars' works that you're reading right now?
Well, I think everything. I mean, what Dwayne said about in his interview with you, and I think in our conversations too, I think you were probably more switched on as an early PhD student than me. When I got into doing my PhD at UBC in curriculum pedagogy, I honestly just thought it was curriculum was going to be about like curriculum design and these kind of things. I had no concept of what curriculum theory was. And to be honest with you, I was totally overwhelmed at first. You know, I remember calling my wife. I was like, I think I'm in the wrong area. Like what I thought I was doing is not at all what I'm doing. And I'm not really sure about all of this. So, I mean, everything has been a revelation to me. Like I really loved my early seminar courses on curriculum theory. You know, and for me, they were history courses. They were history of curriculum. Like let's look at these different intellectual movements. They were history of ideas at that time period. And so, you know, everything from like, you know, going back to Brunner through Schwab, through all of these ways of being able to think in these particular ways, going, you know, in an educational way. But, you know, I think we borrow from so many other areas, also a lot of historiography. So, you know, reading E.H. Carr and Collingwood, Mark Bloch, like getting really into historiography and philosophy of history at the same time period. You know, so many thinkers. And I would say what's most recent, I would say if the biggest switch in my thinking has always been, thinking has always been a big part of it. Critical thinking, my master's, historical thinking in these areas. But I think that my thinking about history and the role and the activist kind of stance about, you know, what is the use of history? If students are not doing anything with it to make a better world, to make better just relations amongst themselves, to do in that way, that's where I think my scholarship has moved more towards. And like, how do we use, if anything, I'd say like these historical thinking things are really crucial tools that you can't build anything. You can't build any understanding without them, but they are tools, and they're tools that we need, you know, we need these other materials to be able to continue to build something useful out of it. And so it's like these tools will help us understand the past and maybe our present and who we are, our own identity, where we might be going in the future, this idea of historical consciousness. But it's also about, you know, thinking about some of these questions, like whether it be Dwayne's scholarship about métissage, whether it be, you know, thinking about anti-racist education, whether it be thinking about decolonization, whether it be thinking about these other kinds of ideas, that they all are kind of influencing them in this particular way. And a scholar right now in Britain, Michael Young, who talks about powerful knowledge, right? This idea, generative kind of knowledge, that these historical thinking concepts function like that in this way, is that they help generate questions about the world and new questions and new understandings that are going to help us and that are really important in life, rather than, he always juxtaposed powerful knowledge with knowledge of the powerful, right? Lots of old curriculum was like, hey, you should learn all the classic pieces of literature. You should learn this one nationalist story or colonial story of our past and learn it in this particular way. That was knowledge of the powerful. That's to fit into like this, you know, upper class or upper crust. But what is it? Let's flip that and think about what does powerful knowledge look like when we're talking about, you know, what do we want students to know and really deeply be able to understand that they can continue to apply and deepen their understanding through their entire lives and not just look at this as a K to 12 thing.
So how long are you planning to stay in Kelowna for?
Well, probably. And there's no urgency to go back to Vancouver now. I mean, my wife and I were we were kind of playing it out of like, where would, you know, if things get really bad, where would we prefer to be? And I don't know, you know, is it like part of it's like, well, big cities have the best facilities to do these things, but then also big cities also have more people that are competing for smaller numbers of resources. So, you know, we could be here, like we joke, so we could be here till the sun, you know, like for 5 months now. We might not, we packed up our apartment thinking like, okay, we might not be back for a while.
And did I wanted to ask you that question before when you were talking about the 1918-1919 pandemic and your research into it? Did you get any sense of how long things were shut down in Victoria for any of the other cities that you've looked into?
Yeah, they shut down. Victoria shut down for 33 days, so it was like October 8th to November 11th, basically. Oh. And it wasn't long enough, as we said. So, you know, like that's a minor kind of thing. So, you know, that's one of those weird things when we talk about history is orientation, right? Like, okay, that's roughly, it's not going to be exact, but that might ballpark me. And if we need to make sure that we don't get second and third waves of the epidemic, of the pandemic, which happened in 1918, then we might want to be thinking about, you know, 3 or 4 months, right?
Yeah, I'm thinking, you know, I'm always thinking about my three sons and they're thinking too about when they're going to go back to school next. You know, a few of them are no rush to go back to school and others would like to see their friends and do the social aspect. And they found out May 4th, but we'll see. We're prepared that they most likely won't go back until September of this year, depending on how seriously everyone takes the different practices that have been put in place in terms of self-isolation and what they're trying to do and their capacity to be able to contain the virus.
And the hard thing too is like, how do you survive, you know, like how do you get yourself through this really difficult time, right? Like we said, we're in really privileged situations that we have jobs that we don't have to go in, but we know this is going to disproportionately affect people who can't not go to work, who don't, you know, who have these other kind of pressures, who work in businesses that, you know, are telling them you need to be in tomorrow, you need to do this kind of work. You know, it's hard to feel really helpless, I feel like, right now in that sense. Like, you know, how can we help at this particular time period, but not put, you know, like my father-in-law's seriously, you know, respiratory compromise. It's like, you know, he lives on the same property that I do in Kelowna. So it's like, how can we respond in this particular time period? Well, it's like, follow the rules and listen, you know, be informed and inform others. And, you know, but it's also a really amazing opportunity. Like, you know, are the three boys they're going to remember this for their whole life. It also maybe gives, like you talked about with Dwayne the other day, like how this has added more balance to your life. I've got a more balanced life right now than I ever have in previous months. You know, is this going to be a little bit of a reset?
Yeah. And the privilege to be able to have an actual home that you can take refuge in as well. I've seen a few tweets on Twitter about the whole notion of, you know, stay the F at home is to have a home to stay within. And being able to do that. But Lindsay, I just want to thank you for taking the time to converse with me today. There's so many more questions that I want to ask you. I know that you and your colleague Carla Peck and others received a huge grant from the federal government in the amount of $2.5 million. So I know that you're in the process of putting things together there with a team that's comprised of museums and different community organizations, colleagues at different universities across the country. And so hopefully in the coming months, you'll be open to coming back and having a conversation with me.
Yeah, sounds great. Thanks for inviting me. And you're part of that grant too, whether you say it or not. But yeah, no, thanks very much for this. It's always nice to talk about things we love.
Yeah, and I'm so happy. I am happy to be part of that grant as well. But thank you for sharing today. And I just thank you, everyone, for listening. And next week, we'll be having a conversation with Hanyu Wang from Oklahoma State University on her work on nonviolence as a positive life energy and thinking about history in that light.